Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the double pleasure of speaking with Dr. Karen O'Brien Kopp from the University of Roehampton and Dr. Suzanne Newcomb from Open University. They are co-editors in a fantastic landmark publication. A collection of a couple scores of essays in the field of yoga studies. It is the Routledge Handbook of Yoga and Meditation Studies. It's an absolute pleasure to be speaking with both of you today about this important publication. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
And of course, some of you may recognize Suzanne from a previous podcast on her work, Yoga in Britain. The first and obvious question is pertaining to the genesis of this, like how did this beast arrive, so to speak?
You want to start, Karen? You started it.
Well, we were approached by Routledge to take on a graduate research handbook in yoga and meditation studies. And Suzanne and I worked from the outset at developing the themes and commissioning the authors. That was quite a long process, but we really wanted to highlight this emerging field of yoga studies and the way that the study of yoga intersects with study of meditation and contemplation in an interdisciplinary way. So the goal from the outset was to bring into conversation researchers who are working in the humanities, the social sciences, and as much as we could in the hard sciences, and to really identify a sort of emerging coherent field of study from a range of subfields that were developing at fast pace in other disciplinary, in a whole range of disciplinary fields of study, in fact. So that was the intention from the outset.
So, Please go on.
Sorry, I should raise my hand. One of the things that really excited me was in taking on this project was the intersection between meditation studies and yoga studies, because yoga studies has now just got enough of a defined field, and there's been so many books published in 2020, in fact, on yoga studies, that it is really a emerging and now almost established field. And of course, Buddhist studies and meditation studies has been around for maybe a decade or two longer, but there's been a kind of lack of discussion between the two. And that was one of the things we wanted to address. And one of the strengths of working with Karen is that she has expertise in the philology and the language study and a more background in classical Buddhism and how that interacts with yoga. And I'm more interested in the contemporary context in terms of modern social history and sociology. And there's a lot of overlap there between people doing, say, Buddhist meditation and doing modern yoga. And that has its own complex particularities. And so what I found particularly fascinating was how we could explore the contradictions and movement of these two fields of studies and these two ways of categorizing embodied practice throughout different contexts and times and disciplines.
That's fascinating. So maybe one of you can give us the lay of the land in terms of the structure of the book or the ways in which the contributions are grouped, and we'll get a richer sense of the sorts of projects we can learn about.
I can do that. I also just wanted to follow up on your initial question, Raj, just to say that in terms of the genesis of the book, I at the time was teaching at SOAS, School of Oriental and African Studies, on an MA program called Traditions of Yoga and Meditation. And as I was pulling together all of these, you know, new topics of research through journal articles and blogs, I really did want to have a kind of one-stop shop for particularly graduate students on this type of program, where there could be a reliable volume that was not comprehensive, but fairly comprehensive in terms of being able to address critical issues and global regional developments in research, as well as to kind of bring readers up to date, bring students up to date on research in the history and development of yoga in South Asia, and to integrate, for example, perspectives from Hindu studies with perspectives from Buddhist studies as well. So I just wanted to add that in there as a kind of another, you know, guiding part of the initial conception.
Yeah, and what I like about that is you're preempting another question that I typically ask, which I think is crucial for how we go about conceiving a project, which is, who's it for? You know, to use modern lingo, what's the market? But really, you know, who are you trying to serve, right? And I think a great frame for this is sort of a one-stop shop for graduate students in these fields. And I suspect the appeal, or the market, if you will, will be broader than that. Who do you think might be interested in the Routledge Handbook of Yoga and Meditation Studies?
Well, we'd love it to be accessible for the general public. And the ebook is not so expensive. So it's about £35. And we're hopeful that Routledge will bring out a paperback in over a year's time. But in the meantime, we're hoping that if you look around for like podcasts like these, and there'll be hopefully blog posts and other bits where you can get the research if you don't have access to a university library. But if you are involved in university at all, tell your library to buy a copy, and hopefully a paperback will be issued.
Fantastic. And so how is the book divided? What are the sections?
So the book is divided into five sections. We have the first part, if I'll just give you a basic overview, is the introduction to yoga and meditation studies, which foregrounds a range of what we felt were important critical perspectives that should, in a sense, frame the reader's entry into the volume as a whole. So, for example, beginning really with Shamim Black's excellent chapter on decolonizing yoga, thinking about some of the current discussions in meditation in contemporary contexts, primarily focusing on Buddhism and Buddhist studies from Villa Huscarl. Andrea Jane's chapter on neoliberal yoga was a really important one for us, and also Mark Singleton and Borean Larios, who discussed the scholar-practitioner identity and its complexities. The next section then is a chronological overview of the history and development of yoga and meditation in South Asia, starting, of course, with the Vedic period into the classical period, and then moving through into different key developments in the medieval period, and bringing the reader all the way up to the 20th century with key historical developments. Suzanne, would you like to pick up with the next section, or would you like me to continue? So the third section is called Doctrinal Perspectives, Technique and Praxis. And this focuses on religious contexts of meditation and or yoga, and includes chapters by experts in Jainism, Taoism, Sikhism, Islam, Christianity, and also an interesting chapter by Masume Rahmani on secular discourses, so looking at mindfulness in the secular sphere. Then the fourth section is called Global and Regional Transmissions, and looks at a range of regional contexts, including Tibet, including insular Southeast Asia, and also includes some new regional studies, either published in English for the first time, or in the case of yoga and meditation in Japan, by Kurita Hidehiko, bringing brand new research to light. This is a really interesting section, I think, because we have the first ever critical overview of the history of yoga in Latin America to be published in English, and similarly for the history of yoga and meditation in Korea. These scholars have been working in their own academic regions for decades, but in the Anglophone sphere of scholarship, we haven't necessarily been aware of this scholarship and these types of publications. So that's, I think, quite an important contribution made through the volume as a whole, but particularly in this section. And then in the last section, section five, we go through a number of different disciplinary approaches to the study of yoga and meditation. And some of these chapters are multidisciplinary, so combining different disciplinary approaches. Some are interdisciplinary. And this is a really interesting survey of all the different types of disciplinary lenses that are being used to understand and assess yoga in contemporary and historical context. So we've got everything from philology to ethnography to cognitive science to critical theory, movement theory, sound studies, and many other disciplinary approaches as well.
Each of these sections actually contains, six, seven chapters and could easily be a volume on its own. This is actually really quite a rich and sort of a vast handbook. I mean, that's why it's a handbook, right? Suzanne, I think there's something you wanted to say.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit about what might seem like a odd editorial choice, which is in the doctrinal perspectives. There's not a chapter for Hinduism. And this is something we worked a lot on and talked a lot on as editors. And we originally thought we wanted a chapter on yoga and meditation in Hindu traditions here. But it became apparent that Hinduism, as is so often the case, was really hard to pin down in any specific way. And so, in fact, the whole history of South Asia section is encompassing traditions we might think about as Hinduism. A Hindu doctrinal perspective comes in the Yogic Body and Global Transmission by Shravana in the fourth section. And so it's more like the traditions of the Indian subcontinent, which we now collect together as Hinduism. They're woven throughout the book, really. So that's why there's not a specific chapter that says this is what yoga and meditation is in Hinduism, because it's just like the concept of yoga and meditation. It is always there in different ways, almost in every chapter.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think it's quite telling that somebody like myself, who fancies himself a Hindu studies expert and in fact hosts a podcast called New Books in Hindu Studies, didn't even notice that. That didn't register for me. And that's a comment really on the way in which I think of Hinduism. It's sort of this jungle. It's just, there are all these strands that we collectively call Hinduism, so many of which that you shed light on in this volume. And it's interesting to me because all of these studies really, they're part of what I think of sort of the ascetic strand of Hinduism or ascetic ideology. I think of it as a double helical structure. But I mean, this Hinduism has no one definition and has all these constituent strands that you're shedding light on. So you actually are shedding light on Hinduism. But to put it under one umbrella as a monolithic thing would probably do a disservice to what you're trying to do in the handbook type thing.
I'm very reassured that you read that as we intended. And I think one of the other interesting things is yoga is often paired with Samkhya. And it's perhaps not obvious, but with the chapter titles, but we do have in the disciplinary section on yoga and philosophy, that one actually focuses much more on Samkhya philosophy and how that relates to yoga. But as we look at in the other, say, doctrinal perspectives, this is not the only philosophy or soteriology associated with yoga, even from a very early time, and probably to some extent Buddhism predates that, although these are all kind of like post hoc labels we've attached to the historical traditions at the time.
Would you say that yoga studies as a discipline has officially been crystallized, that it's a thing now, that this is it, it's here?
We're thinking this over carefully. I think there is an emerging field, or perhaps it has, as you say, crystallized, called yoga studies. But I think in some ways we still would need to see a greater number of undergraduate and graduate programs that are dedicated to yoga studies or that are explicitly, there are a few actually, but there are explicitly called BA in yoga studies or MA in yoga studies, in order for that name to perhaps stick in a more rooted or grounded way. I still think of the, I don't think what we've really captured in the handbook is necessarily the crystallization of a field, but I think it's a snapshot of a very fertile moment in an emerging field. And it's a fast moving series of interdisciplinary investigations. So I think we moved very quickly with this book, even though it's taken probably 3 years from inception to get it published. In fact, we just had a kind of key workshop, which was very productive in terms of bringing the chapters together last year. But having said that, even from the process of commissioning to the process of publication, it feels that a lot has happened in yoga studies in the last year. And we've tried to acknowledge that in the introduction, which we, you know, managed to finish a couple of months ago. By also acknowledging that there are important conversations and directions for study that are now just happening and being published on, and which we didn't necessarily manage to capture. So I still don't think the field is crystallized yet. I think there's, but there's a lot of output happening in different parts of the world, in different types of scholarship.
Indeed, a lot of momentum. Part of the reason why I ask is I've had this really interesting experience this past week where it was asked of me to put together an online weekend school for the OCHS. And I just sort of instinctively thought, well, yoga would be a great topic because, you know, there's some interesting studies that I've come across and something where obviously the wider public would be interested in knowing more about. And I just basically sent an email out to folks that I've been working with or thinking about. And lo and behold, we've amassed 10 contributors to this weekend school. And because of the time frame, I didn't have a theme in mind. And then when I looked over the list, I'm like, wow, everybody on this list has produced a book in 2020, has one forthcoming in 2021, or in some cases in 2019. And they've pretty much all been on this podcast or will be on this podcast, or in your case, are now being podcasted. And I thought, wow, I had this thought experiment for myself, like, wow, yoga studies is obviously a thing. We have all of these, all this production, and we're even going to use that as sort of the frame of the online school, new directions in yoga studies. So this is why I asked you, because obviously, you know, you'd be much more familiar with the scholarship in this area than I am. there really seems to be a ton of activity. And I'm not sure if the lineup of speakers was a surprise to you, but it was sort of was a surprise to me to notice that when I put together that list.
I mean, it was kind of, I didn't quite put it in my head that there are so many books published so recently on the subject. So that was quite exciting, actually. And I have a lot to do in my weekends going forward. But I think that even if, as Karen rightly says, in terms of degree level programs, there still could be a lot more growth. I'm really struck by the amount of student interest and like PhD inquiries I get about people interested in the subject. And as someone who does more sociology of religion, I think it's really interesting in how this overlaps a lot with this kind of like growth of nuns. And if religious studies, it comes from theology and we're studying to some extent ourselves, I think this interest in yoga and meditation and an interest in academic study of it is really reflective of this moment in time and what a huge and growing number of people are drawing upon to give their lives meaning and structure in various ways. So it's quite an exciting moment where there's a self-awareness of drawing on different traditions in our kind of largely European, North American audience in our cultures.
Yeah, there's certainly something happening. There's a number of somethings happening in this generation and this year in particular, but there's something very good happening in 2020 when it comes to yoga studies, if such a thing can be said to exist. Regarding your comment, there's so many, many contributions that I think would be great to touch on. But there is a really interesting contribution in the first section about the scholar practitioner. I think that'd be interesting for one of you to maybe touch on a little bit and tell us about what the article is showing or saying, especially with regard to this interest in yoga, both as a study and a practice among scholars and practitioners themselves. You know, what can you tell us about that article?
You want me to talk, Karen? Or... I think that this is something that I've certainly been in discussions with Mark about for years, and Brian as well. And it's such an interesting and not altogether transparent aspect of the scholar practitioner and who's writing about yoga, who's doing yoga, and what kind of public personas we need to gain credibility for different audiences. And there's in a lot of the initial scholarship on yoga, there was a kind of pushback from practitioners in public areas of discourse that, oh, if you don't practice, you don't have the authority to talk about the subject. But in the academic spheres, you kind of didn't have any authority if you were perceived as identifying with or being too biased towards a particular tradition. And what I think is really interesting in this emerging field over the past 20 years, which is definitely something that about positionality that's become more nuanced in religious studies more generally, is that these distinctions are breaking down and we're becoming a bit more honest about our own positionality and how that relates to the, say, ideals of objective scholarship in whatever discipline you're doing. So it's actually the fact that I think the vast majority, but not all, of the people writing about yoga in contemporary university contexts have some experience of these practices in some way. And what Mark Singleton and Brian Larios talk about are kind of the complexities of these identities and the diversity of them and how they overlap sometimes comfortably and sometimes uncomfortably with say different contexts. So as scholar practitioners of yoga studies, a lot of us have found a kind of a platform and a way of talking about our identities and our professional research that's comfortable in our social context. But a lot of the yoga studies that's going on, say, in India itself, is to very different audiences in a different context. And that has tensions in public dialogue, and in also trying to integrate the different understandings of how to approach, study, and be respectful for yoga that come out of very different intellectual and social traditions.
Fascinating. While you have the floor there, Suzanne, do you want to tell us a little bit about your own contribution to the volume, or the handbook, I should say?
So I, in addition to collaborating with Karen on the editing, I have two other chapters. One is on yoga as a health intervention in India, which draws upon the research I did in the Aeryo project, and is a kind of overview of what I hope to eventually get to in a much more substantive primary source presentation of this. But basically, that chapter is looking at the complex and contested history of how does yoga relate to physical health and more more somatic bodily concerns. And it's got a really long and complex relationship with these concerns, both within India and in our contemporary modern yoga context, which are now global. So one of the things I realized as I was writing this chapter that I found really interesting, and particularly in comparison to how yoga studies relates to meditation studies, is how they really split. The Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was one of the first people who was presenting yoga as science. And in America, this led to the kind of seminal publication of the relaxation response in the 1970s by Herbert Benson and his female collaborator, who tellingly, I can't remember her name at the moment, but it is in the book. That's really bad. And this kind of secularized an approach to yoga studies. And it was this American pushback that then, so you can get the biomedical, physiological benefits of lower blood pressure from this meditation response that doesn't require a religious context. However, within India, this same movement really pushed towards the Hinduization of meditation. So all meditation, all yoga is scientific, and we can prove the medical benefits of yoga through the Indian initiatives into funding scientific research into these subjects. So the same kind of moment that separated yoga from meditation studies in America starts the Indian government's incremental investment in yoga as a healthcare intervention, which of course really accelerated under Narendra Modi's government, but had been brewing definitely since the early 1970s.
Well, Modi, I mean, there's so many, many really fascinating contributions. I think they're about 35 or so. What I think might be interesting is to talk about these rather maybe counterintuitive contributions in part three in terms of Islam and yoga, or Sikhism and yoga, Christianity and yoga. I think that may be fascinating for some of our listeners to hear about. If one of you want to say a word about any of those chapters that involve Taoism, Islam, Sikhism, Christianity, and yoga.
So one of the chapters I think that is really interesting is the opening chapter that considers yoga and meditation in the Jain tradition, by Samani Pratibha Pragya, who is both a scholar, I should say Dr. Samani Pratibha Pragya, and also a Jain nun, a monastic. And this is a really interesting chapter, I think, which in some senses for me occupies a place alongside Florent Delanoue's chapter in section two, which looks at Buddhism and meditation in the same period. In that there's both chapters together, I think, probably with Kengo Harimoto's chapter on the early Vedic Brahmanical expressions of yoga and meditation, show the entanglement, I think, between these three traditions. We have, of course, this evidence from the archaic period of practices and ideas and language related to yoga in the early Vedic texts. But from the time of the emergence of Buddhism and Jainism, we also have this entanglement between the different religious traditions. And I think in particular, the chapter on Jainism brings to light new research that's coming out of Samini's PhD at SOAS, in which she does a very careful and detailed reading of those early canonical Jain sources and what the definitions are and understandings of terms like yoga, practices of meditation, teachings on both these terms and related terms. And I think really highlights the benefits from studying the early history of yoga and meditation in more than one religious context, which can be a big ask, right? Because it takes time to engage with any of these texts. It takes time to learn languages, of course. But for me, there's a great, you know, in my own research, I always wanted to approach the early, and my period is the early common era. I always wanted to approach the early history of yoga by reading the core Hindu texts in context with Buddhist and Jain. And actually, I found out that that was in some sense overambitious. And so I've really just focused myself on Buddhist and Hindu understandings of yoga. But I think this chapter makes a really important contribution in terms of not only giving a detailed understanding of the early Jain period, but actually then she also skips through the medieval period, brings us right up to date with the modern period and 20th century developments in Jain yoga. And in this section, the other chapter that I wanted to highlight was that by Balbinder Singh, which looks at Sikhism, which he proposes that we refer to as Sikhi as part of a decolonial critique of the epistemic violence of the whole world religions paradigm in the colonial period. And this is a really interesting chapter as well that combines close textual analysis with a historical overview. And I think really puts, for me, this is a really important chapter that puts the discussion of Sikhism on the map of yogic studies in the field of yogic studies as an important tradition of South Asia that needs to be considered alongside, for example, the history of Hinduism as well. And this chapter, I think, highlights different aspects in the history of Sikhism, different aspects of the discourse around yoga and its particular political valence in the context of colonialism, in the context of the Sikh identity. So this is, I think, another chapter that covers ground that hasn't been particularly well represented always, outside of its own, I would say, more niche sort of subfield within Sikh studies.
You know, what you say about yoga, the South Asian Indian civilizational India, the analog that comes to mind for me is Tantra, right? I want to study Tantra. So is it Hindu? Is it Buddhist? Is it, you know, but it really bespeaks the porous nature or even the anachronistic nature of what we call Hinduism, right? And so currents like yoga and Tantra, they show us there are vines that sort of traverse the jungle of South Asia. And it's hard to say, well, they stop here and they start there. And even I'm surprised at times to find what I would think of as Hindu deities in a Tibetan Buddhist context. And students sometimes ask me about them. And so it's really, really fascinating, these distinctions, right? And this is why I think that it may be counterintuitive, but the absence of a chapter on yoga and Hinduism actually is you're showing yoga in what can be considered Hinduism throughout this book in some way, shape, or form. There's a couple of questions I wanted to ask. Let's see how specific I want to get for this interview. Please go ahead.
Before you do ask those next questions, could I just add to that last point you made? I just wanted to echo what Suzanne said, that although there isn't a chapter that says yoga and Hinduism, I mean, for me, this is very much the focus of the whole of part two, history of yoga and meditation in South Asia. So that almost exclusively discusses yoga within the context of Hinduism, apart from one chapter, which is more focused on Buddhism. So I just wanted to add that in from my perspective.
Absolutely. What I mean, there's one paper in particular that I wanted to highlight. Were there others that either of you wanted to highlight? I mean, they're also rich, or were there ones that struck you as surprising or particularly innovative or noteworthy in terms of something you weren't aware of before you read the chapter? Like, what sort of jumps out at you?
Well, I have to say that it was a very rich education editing this volume, and it was a complete privilege and honor to be privy to this research and development. I myself did want to highlight the chapter by Adrián Muñoz, which is a kind of summary overview of yoga in Latin America. As I mentioned, this is the first time that this research has been gathered and published in English, even though there is, of course, a strong community of academic researchers on yoga and meditation in Latin America. So this was really interesting for me in terms of seeing what those parallel developments were in the early 20th century in various Latin American countries with the arrival of Indian gurus, the ways in which different branches or schools of yoga developed in sometimes very much in sync with the types of developments we've seen in the Euro-American context, but also with different emphases and different schools that became prominent. So that for me was a really interesting chapter, and I definitely look forward to hearing more about developments in that part of the world.
For me, what was the most exciting bit about putting this book together was actually the workshop we had in between the first and second drafts, where most of the chapter authors were able to come to London, and we had two whole days where we exchanged papers and reactions to the papers, and it was very conversational. And what I found most personally enriching was, perhaps like Karen, some of the perspectives that are furthest from my area of understanding. So I particularly found interesting Charles Lee's explanation of how you create a kind of a genealogy of a text through kind of new digital technology. And I also found the summaries of psychopathology and cognitive sciences really helpful, because these are areas that I don't feel like I've got my own personal map of, is quite sketchy. So it was really helpful to have some of my blind spots and areas of ignorance exposed and discussed with in a really collegial manner. And so when thinking about the reader picking up this book, I'd really encourage you to go to the chapters that aren't your area of expertise, or maybe something that you didn't think that you were interested in, because I think that's where we really get to know ourselves better and how to ask better questions about the areas we're interested in.
And that's part of the real strength of the enterprise. Not only the individual fascinating in-depth studies, but this can be sort of a one-stop shop where you can even, by coming into the shop, you know what sort of spices you missed out on or that you don't know about, type thing, just to use an analogy of a spice shop.
Absolutely. I think one of my favorite chapters in that regard was Finian Geraghty's one on Om and
I was
sound.
So, I was just about to ask, I didn't know how to ask, but I'm like, can somebody touch on Finian Geraghty's article? I was going to say for my own personal selfish interest, but please go ahead.
I mean, as someone who's not an expert in Sanskrit at all, I was just really struck by the profound importance of orality in soundscapes. And the respondent we had at the workshop was from sound studies. And I know this has been something my colleagues in religious studies have been interested in for a while, but I didn't really engage with it. And how many of our practices of yoga and meditation really have this important oral element, be it imagined or actually sounded or vibrated in some way. And this is obviously such a doctrinally important part of the Indian traditions, is the sound and the vibrations, and how that actually, I found it really fascinating personally, how that, I hadn't considered it in terms of my own experience, and how pervasive it actually is. So that's a really exciting field for I think all of us to pay more attention to is what is our soundscapes, what are our sound landscapes, that kind of thing.
And isn't it interesting that we, I mean, I happen to be a textual scholar. I don't know why. I quite enjoy it, but I'm not sure how that happened. I really should have done ethnography. But I have this podcast to fill that niche in my life so I can talk to people professionally. But isn't academia, isn't scholarship via text? I mean, aren't we kind of used to reading and thinking in those terms, right? It's perhaps unsurprising that it takes a bit of a reframe for us to refamiliarize ourselves with the fact that the text is uttered. It's an utterance, right, in many cases, and the impact that has on religiosity and theology and et cetera, especially in what one might call the Hindu religious tradition. I ended up, I think, organizing a panel on sonality. Finian was on a few years ago at the AAR. It was lots of fun, actually. What else do you want to maybe touch on about the volume? I know you're both very busy and we'll close fairly shortly, but was there anything in particular that you wanted to highlight or share about the volume?
I think I wanted to very briefly highlight some of the topics that we mentioned in the introductory chapter, which is called Reframing Yoga and Meditation Studies, where there is this acknowledgement that we weren't able to include everything we wanted to. And because of the way a large project like this is put together with deadlines, we had to draw a line under the commissioning process at a certain point. At a point we feel in 2020, where there are new developments and new voices coming into the field. So I suppose for me, it would be important to acknowledge that there's still a lot of research and a lot of work to be done, and which will be coming into our awareness in the next couple of years. For example, developments on yoga in China, I think, are particularly interesting. Regionally, there hasn't really been much published yet on yoga in the Middle East, or indeed yoga in Africa, where there are lots of different developments in the continent. And although I think we've got some really excellent critical perspectives on yoga, from decolonization to Karen Ann Wong's chapter, which is looking at both childhood and sexuality as well in her, and gender as well in her chapter, I think there are important thematic contributions on the horizon on the themes of yoga and critical race theory, yoga and whiteness, as a kind of continuation of that ongoing discussion of cultural appropriation, and also yoga and abuse, yoga and sexual abuse, yoga and coercion, because we've now got this new major funded research project, which it's just starting to come to the fore. So I think it's important to acknowledge that there are lots of new areas and new topics that are going to be coming into our sort of discourses and conferences and workshops in the next couple of years as well. And if I can mention something else, I don't know quite how it works with the timing of the podcast release, but we do have a launch for the book coming up at SOAS on the 23rd of November, which will also be recorded and archived on their YouTube channel. And that's going to feature some of the authors in discussion, talking about their chapters. And it will also be chaired by Professor Chakravarti Ramprasad. So I think that will be a really interesting conversation as well, if people wanted to follow up after the podcast.
Oh, that's a great opportunity. Speaking of which, in the timeless time of podcasts, it's difficult to know what is future, past, and present in terms of what's coming up. But both Karen and Suzanne, both of these co-editors, will be sharing on this very publication at the upcoming OCHS, that's the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, weekend school dedicated to yoga studies, new directions in yoga studies. They'll have a slot where they will be sharing more on this research alongside nine other cutting edge researchers in the field sharing their groundbreaking work. That's on December the 5th and 6th of the weekend. For those of you hearing this before that point, by all means, consider attending. It should be lots of fun. But maybe more importantly, given the longevity of podcasts, for those of you hearing this beyond December 5th, 6th, 2020, we will make available to you the recordings of this through the OCHS. If you want to go to the OCHSonline.org, I believe is a website. And that should be lots of fun. It's been sort of a surreal pleasure and honor this week to just tinker away at this list of speakers and watch it just become this you know, the symphony of expertise. It's staggering to me that there's so much happening without trying. I think 80% of you have books out this year. It's so interesting to me.
I think if there's one other thing I'd quite like to highlight is that as Karen says, a lot of the chapters point towards ongoing issues that we weren't able to fully explore, but there's ongoing research. And so some of the chapters which might feel a bit too thin, hopefully there'll be much more emerging on that in the near future. And something there is actually quite a lot of work on that might not seem obvious to all yoga scholars is I'd like to highlight in Julian Strube's chapter, which is on yoga and meditation, modern esoteric traditions. And this actually taps into a really rich field of research that's been ongoing in German-speaking countries for a number of years, which is exploring the hundreds of years of intercultural exchange between Europeans and Indians in both health and religious thinking. And what Julian's research highlights, as well as particularly Carl Bayer and the research network he's building in Vienna, is the really profound interconnections between ideas of health and subtle bodies. And I think the takeaway from this is that the Indian traditions have influenced European thinking a lot more than we realize or understand. And there's going to be a lot more research unpacking the mutually transformative encounters that have been going on for a lot longer than we normally realize.
Indeed. And you know, the way I think of good books as, I think of good books as beginnings of inquiry rather than sort of finales or conclusions. Or the best of books, they chart a course off the beaten path and now you're in the wilderness of what they've opened up. And I think the same can be said for the best of handbooks, that also it's a beginning and it equally shows you the lay of the land and it points to areas for future development. So I think we will close for today. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having us.
You're very welcome. We have been speaking with Suzanne Newcomb and Karen O'Brien Cock, co-editors of the Routledge Handbook of Yoga and Meditation Studies, hot off the presses, 2020. They will be presenting on the handbook alongside other yoga scholars at the OCHS Online Weekend School, December 5th or 6th. You're all welcome to attend. Until next time, stay safe. Priority number one, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the variety of things we call yoga. Take care.